Yeah, thanks for coming. Thanks for not being fed up with talk. So I'm going to talk about work on setting up definitions for reflection positivity or unitarity in the setting of TQFTs. And for today, I will restrict myself to spin TQFTs. And most things work for more general tangential structures, but spin is somehow the first case where you see most of the important features. Yeah, I should also say this is joint work with a lot of people, and then in particular with Luke Stiehauer, where also part is already on the archive, and the part with 13 hours or so should be on the archive soon. Theo is involved, so he is here. You might get upset if I'm not mentioning him. Anyway, let me start a bit more broadly. It's like if you ask someone what is a QFT or what are the important parts of a QFT, they usually tell you, or sometimes they tell you key features. I mean, we might not know what a QFT is, but some key features we know. And they say it's like local and unitary. And unitary, I mean, depending on whom you ask, you might not care that much about that. But if you ask old school or if you ask enough people, you sometimes will get this answer. And so any sufficiently good mathematical model of QFTs should somehow be able to encode these two things. And one thing which at least we think we understand via topological field theories, which have a rigorous formulation in the Artier-Siegel framework or the functorial field theory setting, and locality is somehow in this setting what leads to extended theories. And then unitarity somehow has been studied before by many people, and recently by Fried and Hopkins, but somehow so far it works for non-extended theories, and they give a definition for invertible, fully extended theories. But I want to highlight that at least in the TQFT setting, somehow there's no framework which encodes both things. And just want to somehow explain a bit what our proposal is to solve this problem and generally what type of questions correspond to that. But let me somehow ask. Try to relate this mathematical question to something more physical. So if you have a, let's say, unitary QFT, I mean, this is far from being topological, but somehow there are certain aspects which you should be able to capture by something, at least in the realm of TQFT. And recently, many people got interested in somehow things one can extract from such an object, like somehow higher categories of topological defects. Or extended observables, so they higher categories. So these things, they are somehow well-defined objects one can extract from a quantum field theory, and somehow the question is really what. Or a different way of phrasing the same question, I think, is like what adjectives we should put here to correspond to the unitary setting. I mean, I think for the point observables of a theory, it's usually well understood. So if I have something like an algebraic quantum field theory, I'm able to extract some C star algebra of observables. And then maybe if I have I don't know, something like a factorization algebra or so, I'm getting a vector space. But then if the theory is unitary and I have some type of operator state correspondence or so, there's a Hilbert space. So these things should also be Hilbert spaces usually. So maybe a different question is like what's a categorified Hilbert space, or what's a categorified C star algebra? So what type of structure does one find on these type of things? And then I now have just a really brief bit about general things in QFT, and then I will specialize to TQFTs, and also a bit just what one gets. So the first observation is.
Maybe one question because the one about extended theories that you mentioned, there's a you draw an arrow between local and extended. Rail framework is would be related to
Yes, yes, exactly. The locality, if you want to model it in the functorial setting, is the same as working with extended borderism categories, where you somehow you somehow allow to cut your manifolds along arbitrary codimensions, so you can cut them down to disks, which then is like the local picture.
That's the objective and goal. You have the objective and that's.
I mean, you have these two things, right? These are somehow things people tell you your Q of T should have. And then if you have a model of a QFT, you should somehow make these things precise. And like I think the main idea of topological quantum field theory is really to build in the locality manifestly in the setting of extended theories. And then unitarity is not that well studied. That's somehow the point. And I want to suggest some ways of getting around this. But I mean, OK, so. And then there's also reflection positivity in the title. So I should probably explain how reflections and positivity relate. So, and when I say reflection, I really mean just orientation reversal for a manifold. So assume we have some partition. So I'm now pretend that there's something like a path integral where I can write my partition function as an integral of some action for some fields which live on M. And this should generally be given by some integral over some Lagrangian density or so. And now I can ask what's the partition function on the same manifold but with reversed orientation. And if I reverse the orientation, integration changes sign. So this will become e to the minus I. That's fine. And if the action is real, this implies that this is the same as the complex conjugate of the partition function. So the upshot here is that somehow orientation reversal should correspond to complex conjugation in a theory. And if I have an operation like orientation reversal, what I can do is I can start now with some manifold M, which has a boundary, and I might have some operators, and the boundary is sigma. Then I can compute the path integral for this manifold with boundary, which will give me a state in the Hilbert space associated to sigma. And I, instead of just reversing the orientation, I can somehow reflect the whole picture. So I can define. And then so I take the picture and reflect it and define a manifold I call M dagger. And now I can glue these two things together. So I glue this thing on the bottom. And then from the, where I can evaluate my theory on this, which will give me some number, some complex number. And from the general framework of like path integrals formally, one can see that this should be the same as the norm of this vector here in the Hilbert space associated to the boundary. And I mean, this is complex antilinear in this thing, so this reflection somehow needs to be complex antilinear for this to work. Yeah. What? Is that, does this work? Is that good? Okay.
One other thing, because I associate reflection positivity, and this might be wrong, but I associate it with more Euclidean field theory.
Yes.
And the exponential reorder there has a complex.
Yes. It's something I'm really puzzled about. It's because this seems, I mean, I think we've, I mean, you also need, I mean, yeah, this is not exactly reflection positivity. I think reflection positivity is somehow you do this operation and you want these numbers to be positive. But there will be no complex conjugation. And then if you Vic rotate back, this is how you get the Hilbert space. But this reflection going to complex conjugation seems more like a Lorentzian thing. Really puzzling for me. I mean, mostly the naming is puzzling, not the facts, which is free Topkins.
Sure.
But no, but they rebranded the term. Right, they said it's something reflection, which they mean this, and positivity. If you read like older, like constructive AQFT things, they don't have anything that has a complex conjugation. the more they put that in by hand. No. Okay, so this is my general motivation of where we want to go. But QFTs are hard, so we study TQFTs, and that would be the next thing, is just to briefly recall the formalism. But are there questions? Oh, okay, if not, we also try to. And then anyway. And this is now also the point where we restrict to spin. So this is a 5-minute review of what a TQFT mathematically is. So we fix some space-time dimension n, and then one defines a category of Bohrisms where the objects are n minus one dimensional manifolds equipped with a spin structure. This is like a sigma, and this should be a sigma prime here. And then the morphisms are given by this type of manifold with boundary, where one boundary is identified with sigma, the other one with sigma prime, and they're usually called cobordisms. And the theory is somehow an axiomatization of properties one would expect from a path integral. So the first thing the theory should do is should associate some vector space of states to these time slices, or these n minus one dimensional manifolds. So there's a vector space Z of sigma and Z of sigma prime, which, since we are working with fermions, will always be a super vector space. And then this manifold M tilde should correspond to a linear map given by computing the path integral on M. And even though we don't know how to do that formally, we can just say, okay, this is something one could extract if it would exist. And now let's just see what type of properties. And somehow locality, or how locality is built in, is via the following property. If I have a manifold, so this whole thing I call M, and then I cut it up, so I cut it open here and here, and it becomes three manifolds. So I have an M1, an M2, and an M3, which bound certain surfaces along a codimension one manifold along which I cut. Then via this procedure, I will get linear maps associated to all of them. So I get, for example, I get here, the boundary is empty. So I get a map from the vector space associated to the empty set, which we always identify with the complex numbers, a linear map to the vector space associated to this codimension one manifold, another one, and then a last one. And I can compose all of these things. And the locality statement somehow that this composition of these local pieces corresponds to computing along the path integral, or this linear map along the glued manifold. So I write M1 composed with M2 for this gluing operation. And then I want that if I compose these two maps, it agrees with this map. And then finally, if I compose with M3, I want to get the same as if I would just apply the map to M. And now I get a map from C to C, which is linear. So this I can identify with a complex number, which is the usual partition function. And somehow, mathematically, one can think of these things as invariants of manifolds, which can be computed by cutting and gluing them. Like we can cut and then glue back together. And on top of that, we will require these manifolds to be spinned throughout the talk. And this is somehow, you could do oriented, unoriented, or whatever for any type of tangential structure, you will get a notion of a field theory. Okay. But now, so the note that the target I've written down is super vector spaces and not something like super Hilbert spaces, as one might expect. She wanted to do. Let me make this comment first and then the example. So the target is super vector spaces, but you would have expected me to say something, it's a state space, so it better be a Hilbert space. And I could have given the same definition with super Hilbert spaces, but then the problem is I have a map, or I have a functor here which just forgets that it was a Hilbert space, and this turns out to be an equivalence, so the definition would not depend on the Hilbert space anyways. So this is somehow a puzzle or something one might, which I want to answer, and this is, I think, as far as I know, first, probably it has been raised before, but The reference I know, the oldest one, is by John Byers from like 2006, and he also more or less already sketches the solution I will present. Okay, and then we should do an example of a TQFT, so we have a spin TQFT, so we look at 1D series, and then they are equivalent to giving a super vector space. So this is, I mean, in 1D, we somehow just have things which look like this, and then maybe some closed circuits. And the vector space is the value on a point. So this is the value on a point. And then in addition, it comes with a Z2 action. So Z2 acts on this. And how does and what does it correspond to in the field theory? So a spin structure on a 2D manifold is just a double cover. So it's so I can have this map. Now I should give you a double cover. And if you look at the non-trivial double cover, this is a map from V to V, which generates and then this should be finite dimensional. So from now on, all vector spaces are finite dimensional. This will generally, whatever, like this definition forces your values to be finite dimensional anyway, so we will just assume it from now on. And now, so the next thing I want to explain is how, when I start with something like super vector spaces, I can go to something like super Hilbert spaces. Like somehow how I can record the information of being a super Hilbert space. And this is the other things I prepared. Some information about the category of supervector spaces. So one thing is it has an involution by complex conjugation, and it hence has two involutions. And now, before getting the questions, I just spell exactly out what it does. So it takes a supervector space, it sends it to the complex conjugated vector space, which, as I said, is just the same. But I denote the elements by V bar. And then scalar multiplication is just via complex conjugation. A linear map gets mapped to whatever it does. Like you just apply the map and think of it as a map between V bar and W bar. Then this is supposed to be symmetric monoidal. So I give you an isomorphism from this tensor product to this, which is the obvious thing. It needs to be compatible with the units. So if I take the complex conjugate of C, I need to give an isomorphism to C, which is just actual complex conjugation. And I need to give you coherence, how this squares to the identity. So if I do it twice, I want to get V back, and I just use this map. So this now fixes my Z2 action completely, and hopefully Theo seems more happy than usually when I talk about this.
Sorry, one question. You mentioned two Z2 actions, and I forgot. I didn't understand. What was the essential point of mentioning these actions are?
I mean, they are two ways the group Z2 can act on supervector spaces if you want it to be linear over the reals. One is the one I presented. The other one is the one which does this. So there's a choice, and I just explicitly told you which choice I make. This is just.
So somehow these are instantiations of the Z2 action you're defining more specifically.
Yeah, I'm more specifically explaining what complex conjugation is. And I mean, where we are going is somehow we define these type of actions on the algebraic target super vector spaces, and then we define similar involutions on the Bordism side, and we require equivariance for those. This is where we want to go. The next thing is there's also the two group BZ2, so this is just a delooping of Z2, and I put an F there just to remember what Z2 it is on S-vect, and let me just briefly sketch here what it means to act with a two group on a category, so it's just given by a map of groups from BZ2 to the automorphisms of C. So it sends a point to the identity, and minus one should be sent to some natural transformation from the identity to itself, which also in addition squares to the identity. Okay, now how does this relate to Hilbert spaces? So from the data I have, I can build an anti-involution on SVECT, which sends a vector space to the dual vector space and complex conjugation. And now if I restrict this to the underlying groupoid, I get an induced Z2 action because like the op I can trivialize by inverting. And then I can look at fixed points for this. So they in particular are given by maps from V bar dual to V. So this rewriting this, you will get some type of pairing. And it turns out that these things are actually Hermitian pairings. Okay. Okay, now our next goal is to look at a similar type of structure on a Bordesen category. So what we want to find, so we want to construct some D2 action on this spin Bordesen category, and it should mimic orientation reversal. For this, let me just say what a spin structure actually is, or one way of saying what it is. So it's a principal spin N bundle on the manifold. Together, so if I have this principal bundle, and then I can form the associated vector bundle for the spin representation. So spin maps to N, which acts on Rn, giving me a principal bundle. So I get this vector bundle, and then the spin structure in addition is an isomorphism from this to the tangent bundle of M. Okay, and I want to define now the orientation versus for a manifold with a spin structure. So I take P and alpha and define its orientation reversal. And just some orientation reversal of P, some orientation reversal of alpha. And there's a standard way of reversing orientations of spin bundles, which first builds a pin bundle. So I take the associated pin plus N bundle. Now this has a copy of P sitting inside, and I remove that. So I take out P, and then spin acts here by right multiplication because it's the subgroup of pin plus. So in this way I define the orientation reversal. And then I also need to tell you what alpha bar is. So alpha bar should be a map from P bar Rn over spin. Tm. And so something in here, it's an equivalent class given of some P, something in the pin group, and some vector x. And this will be mapped. So I have the old alpha, which I can apply to P. Then I can act with E on x. And this maps to Tm, and it's like a way of saying somehow this, in addition, also reverses the orientation of the spin. I'm running out of shock. Okay. And the statement is that this construction somehow is. I mean, I only did something to the tangential bit. I didn't do anything to the manifold, so it's reasonably believable that it gives a map, an automorphism of the Bordesen group, which is also symmetric monoidal. And then in addition, there's also an action of BZ2. See? And so I need to give you its component. So I need to give you, how do I call it? I call it C. So I need to give you its component at an object sigma, which is a map from sigma to sigma. And any type of diffeomorphism gives me a morphism in the Bordesen category. By looking at a mapping cylinder over that. So I just take, here I take the spin flip, which really means like the spin group has a non-trivial element in its center. So this is like, I mean, the spin group is a Z2 extension of O(n). And this is the C is somehow the non-trivial element in there. And then I can act with this on any spin structure by just acting on the principal bundle. So this gives me an automorphism here. And this gives me a BZ2 action. And it's exactly what was the Z2 action we had before. Okay. And now I can give definition of what it means for topological field theory to satisfy spin statistics and have a reflection structure. Okay, I'm not sure what's a good use of blackboards. Just by saying it's equivariance data for these actions. So I have a map V from this spin. I will drop the spin, everything is spin, to S vect. And now I say it's a cathode reflection structure. I define a reflection structure to be Z2 equivariance. And then spin statistics is BZ2 equivariance. So what does this mean? Z2 equivariance means that I get a map from sigma bar to Z of sigma bar. So that there is an isomorphism here, meaning that orientation reversal on the Bordesian side corresponds to complex conjugation on the manifold side, and this is really data. This is some data. One has to specify. That's why it's called reflection structure and not reflection theory. And spin statistics in this dimension or in this setting becomes a property, namely that if I evaluate the theory on a spin flip, I get -1 to the F. So this is the automorphism on this board on a C on sigma. Okay. And now the next thing is going to be to explain what positivity means and then sketch how to extend this, what an extended theory is and how to extend it. Okay. But before defining positivity, we need one additional fact about the Bordesian category, namely that it has duals. So if I look at an object in there, I have a dual object. So this is as a dual object, this is just the same. So I leave sigma the same, I leave p the same, but I change alpha to alpha dual. And now I should, so in this setting, what I do is I still have a spin n bundle over sigma, even though sigma is only n minus one dimensional. So I do spin n rn. And then alpha now should not go to the tangent bundle of sigma, but I stabilize once. And now I can define alpha dual to be this map composed with the identity plus -1. So this does just a reflection in this extra dimension. So it somehow lets things like this extra dimension, you should maybe think of something like an arrow of time, so it somehow flips. Error of time. Okay. And now, maybe skip this. But what one can now show, which I'm not going to, just like a reasonably straightforward exercise in differential geometry, that if I have a map an isomorphism between sigma and between a triple like this, and the following, I can take this, take its dual, and take its bar. And these things are isomorphic. And I mean, I can give you a precise formula, but it's probably not going to be that enlightening. There's just a preferred isomorphism like this. I mean, in the setting of oriented series, somehow both these operations would reverse the orientation. Here it's slightly more complicated because I also do some stuff to the principal bundle. But it satisfies one important property, which is that if I look at this isomorphism, then it's actually equal. So what I can do is that I can take its dual and reflection reverse it, so I get a map like this. I get a map to here. And the double dual is the identity, double reflection reverses the identity. So this is an isomorphism here to sigma, and then this composition is equal to that. And this is somehow similar to the symmetry condition for Hermitian pairing. So generally, we will call something like this a Hermitian pairing on our theory. And now the nice thing is, if I have a reflection theory, I can evaluate it on H sigma, which gives the map from Z of sigma. And I mean, now I will sometimes like move a bar to the other side or so and still call these things H sigma. I can use this isomorphism to build a map from Z of sigma bar to Z of sigma dual. And now I know that this functor I have a preferred isomorphism to the complex conjugated vector space here. And here I have an isomorphism to the dual vector space. This just uses that any symmetric monoidal functor preserves duals. And I have a map here, which is something, right? So this is a dual vector space. So this map is actually defines an Hermitian pairing on the vector space associated to sigma. Yes.
I understand n plus is the extension where I'm reversed on the squares to the
pair. Yes.
Yeah, right. And you're using that there, right? You try to write down a property satisfied by this H.
Yes.
And you have to pick.
I mean, you can probably pick pin minus and then twist some other stuff, and that works. What?
You don't have to do any twisting. P bar is a well defined thing, independent of all of. This could have written the same formula with pin minus. Yeah, you actually get the same involution on spin structures. This is not supposed to be obvious, but there is like a God given involution on spin structures,
yeah,
which has many formulas.
Okay. Yeah.
One of the formulas is the one with this row.
Yeah. One thing which I might give you something else is this isomorphism. Because this is the isomorphism here. I mean, I didn't tell you what it is, but this also uses some pin stuff. And if you pick pin minus, it might change certain things.
I believe that there is it's like one God-given isomorphism.
Yeah.
And that, well, there is a question of whether the formula for this.
Okay.
Right, and like if Lucas's formula for p bar uses pin plus, then maybe his formula for h sigma will also use pin plus.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I'm telling you is that there is a formula that looks identical except because of pin minus.
Yeah.
It's like a big fact, but actually it didn't matter which pin number it is.
Yeah.
So you can actually sort of see this, like when he writes, actually you can just see this directly from the formula. Like the formula here uses pin plus as a spin module, but it never uses the group structure on pin plus.
Yes.
It just uses the fact that pin plus is like two copies of spin.
Yeah.
And it uses a little bit about how what pin plus, like it uses the fact that pin plus is a spin-spin bimodule. But pin plus and pin minus are the same as spin-spin bimodules.
Now I can give the first definition, which is due to Fried and Topkin, which says Z is reflection positive if Z evaluated on all these Hermitian structures defines a super Hilbert space. Okay. And then a nice exercise to see is in 1D, if I want to figure out what are 1D series, they're actually equivalent to now just specifying V, which is a super Hilbert space, but nothing more, because somehow this condition with the reflection will fix the spin involution to be the involution we had to before to be the spin flip. Okay.
So this is sort of a Cavorism hypothesis for.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
This is where I might go at the end. Let me mention this because I might not get there. If I look at 2D, then this is equivalent to super two Hilbert spaces. This is the theorem I wanted to at least mention. That's where we are trying to go. If it's fully extended, this is a super two Hilbert space.
So you know what either side of that equivalence means.
Yes.
Okay.
And depending on time, I might not. But I will try. But yeah, I mean, this is somehow what we would somehow the spin case in the unitary setting is like the framed case in the non-unitary setting, I would say, if that makes sense. Okay, let's reformulate what we did so far by drawing a diagram. So I have this thing, which has a Z2 action. Then in here, like for the objects, we have fixed these Hermitian structures, and these are objects in here, so I have a map in there, and then I can also build a groupoid of those by just allowing all invertible maps between them, or all invertible maps which are compatible with sigma. Then up here, I also have the underlying groupoid, and here I have the anti-involution, which both takes the dual and orientation reversal. So I can look at fixed points for those. And then these things turn out to exactly be these fixed points. So I have a lift like this. And now I have a reflection theory. So I have some Z2 equivariant thing to here. This is Z2 equivariant, meaning because it will automatically preserve duals, it induces a map to the fixed points here, which again sit in here. And now my diagram is slightly bad. So Hilbert spaces and unitary maps sit in here and map to here. And so from a reflection theory, I automatically get a diagram like this, and then positivity somehow the condition that it actually lifts through here. So this is exactly. Okay.
So we predict the ET 2D to Hugh.
Oh, that's this is like what should be on the board at the end, but it will probably not.
Just doesn't make sense.
He hasn't said anything.
Here I should have said 2D fully extended.
But you are not at all talking about extended things.
Yep, that's why I said this should be on the board at the end and not now. I'm trying to get.
So you mean, you are using the Cavorism hypothesis
to prove something like this? Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. It's somehow, right, the Kobozny hypothesis tells you what spin fixed theories are, and then somehow there's like a nice way of identifying the things showing up in the spin fixed points with just the things showing up in the definition of unitarity, which makes a statement like this true. I mean, you might also hope this to be true by definition somehow. Right. I mean, so differently, I could have defined a two-Hilbert space to be a unitary, fully extended spin theory. Okay. We have 20 minutes, okay. Okay, I just want to briefly explain how to reformulate this type of definition in terms of what's called a Dagger category. And then we'll probably just mention a bit about the extended things. So definition, a Dagger category. So it consists of the following data. We have a category C, which comes with a functor which reverses the direction of morphisms. But is the identity on objects and strictly squares to the identity. So this is usually in category theory you would not like this, but somehow it's exactly what corresponds to the picture over here. So let me at least sketch how this works. So the Bordism category actually gets a Dagger structure by doing the following thing. I mean, on objects, I said it needs to be the identity. And now if I have a morphism M from sigma 1 to sigma 2, what I do is first I reverse its orientation and take its dual. So this now goes from sigma 2 bar dual to sigma 1 bar dual. And now I have the Hermitian structures, which I can use to identify this with. And this is what I define to be M Dagger. And similarly, Hilbert spaces have a structure like this where the Dagger is just the usual adjoint of an operator. And then there's a theorem, which is due to Luke Stiehauer and him and Jan Steinebrunner. Which essentially says reflection positive TQ of T's are equivalent to Dagger functors. And there's also work which is somehow complementary to Fried Hopkins, which studies the Dagger side, which is by Craig, Stolz, and Teichner. Okay. So this somehow wraps up my summary of the non-extended case. And now I will spend the last 15 minutes or so explaining a bit about how to extend these things. If I find chalk. But are there questions up to now? Okay. If not, let me sketch what extended means. And so it just means somehow before we had some manifold, we allowed to cut like this. But this is not enough to reduce the topology to something simple. And now in addition, we want to also allow cuts going in some other directions. And depending on how many directions you allow, you talk about more and more extended series. And the new feature is somehow that corners appear at places where you cut. So let me give a more formal definition. Let me, because I can only draw nicely in like the two-dimensional case, I just say is there's an extended two-dimensional Bordism category, which is now a two category, which has some objects. They are just given by by zero-dimensional spin manifolds. One morphisms are given by paths, so they are given by one co-Bordisms, and then two morphisms are given by Bordisms of Bordisms. Yes, sir. So here, this is, so first of all, you might have expected to see something which looks more like this with points on the sides, but these things are hard to compose in two directions. So we just take these points and blow them up to some small intervals. Topologically, this doesn't make a big difference. And now this picture here is a two morphism from the one morphism, which is just these two straight lines to the one morphism, which is this elbow and that elbow. Should probably have oriented things, but let me not. And then composition is just by gluing. And since it's a two category, there are now two directions of composition. So I can glue these things horizontally or vertically. And then want to map this somewhere. And usually people map it to a bicategory of superalgebras. But this turns out to be equivalent to certain super categories. Let me just say something like fully dualizable or semi simple. So the objects are C-linear categories enriched over supervector space. So they are categories such that these Homm spaces are supervector spaces. The one morphisms are functors. And the two morphisms are natural transformations. The functors should be linear over supervector spaces. And then a theory somehow would assign a category to a point, a functor to a Bordism like this, and a natural transformation to a Bordism like that. And now you could somehow try to take the definition which is gone and just extend it to this extended setting by figuring out what is a Degas bicategory and then just declare this thing to be a Degas bicategory. And this is exactly our approach, which, then I will just say a few words about in the last few minutes. So the first thing to note is that Degas categories were all about anti-involution. So they were all about maps from C to C op. And why is this something which is somehow significant? It's due to the following fact. If I look at the automorphisms of the to one category of categories, this turns out to be a Z2. And the only action maps, the only non-trivial one is exactly the one which maps C to C op. And the Degas structure was a fixed point for this action on categories, or something like, it's built out of a fixed point for this action on categories. So you might expect that a Degas bicategory, you should ask what are the automorphisms of bicategories. Okay, that's a bit late. the automorphisms of bicategory. So this is a 3-1 category, and this turns out to be Z2 times Z2. So I can take the opposite of one morphisms, but I can also take the opposite of two morphisms. So I have two Z2 actions. But then there's also one other thing one should at least consider, and reclaim is an important thing to consider. These Bordism categories, they have all adjoints. So they are actually categories which, in addition, have all adjoints. So I can also ask, what are the automorphisms of bicategories with adjoints? And we don't know. But what we do know is it contains a copy of O2. So there is an action of the orthogonal group on by categories with adjoins, and the conjecture or the expectation is somehow that this is O2. Okay.
You must mean the truncation of O2.
I mean O2 is truncated, but yes.
O2 has.
But yeah, I mean the truncation.
O2. But I mean.
But I would also, even if it's not truncated, I can still talk about an action that would just factor through the truncation. But O2, I'm.
Okay, so I'm confused by the fact that O3 is not true.
Yes, but there's no O3 here. If I would have three categories here, there would be some truncation, yes. Okay. Okay, now somehow the idea is to set something up which we call an O2 dagger structure, an O2 dagger by category. And this consists of two parts. The first part is a fixed point for this O2 action. And the second part is somehow trivializations on objects and one more business. So, and you should compare it to the diagram, which is also gone, where we had the Bordesen category, which had a Z2 action. And then we had some trivialization of the Z2 action on the object. And this is similar in flavor. I mean, I was hoping to give more details, but I think I will probably not do that. But I mean, maybe let me at least explain a bit of what this O2 action does. So I already said this O2 is just a semi-direct product of S1 with Z2. So this is the same as homotopy equivalent to a classifying space BZ and the semi-direct product with Z2. So for this to act on bicategories with adjoints, I need to give you an action of Z2. This maps the category C, let's say, to the one opposite, a bicategory, to the bicategory which reverses the direction of one morphism. I could equally well have taken the thing which reverses the option a direction of two morphisms. And in addition, I need to give you an action of BZ, which is a natural transformation from the identity to itself. So I need to, for every B, I need to give you such a map, and it's the map which takes a one morphism and maps it to a double right adjoint. Okay, 5 minutes. I will now just tell you some things we can prove. I mean, it's hard. I know that now somehow the details are not completely there, but I hope that at least you believe that a definition like this makes somehow sense, and it's well motivated because it just really extends the non-extended version to the setting. I mean, maybe one reason why we think that O2 is better than Z2 times Z2, it's somehow in an extended theory I have objects of co-dimension 2 sitting somewhere. And if I want to talk about something like reflection, I can somehow do, but there's no reflection which is preferred, so I can do all these reflections. And if I do all of them, I generate O2 and not Z2. This might be some idea. No, let me just
state
to series, which is the extended Bordism category is O2 dagger. The second one is like this. The super categories over C are also O2 dagger. And this is just the same as saying this is somehow given by defining what a super Hilbert space, a super two Hilbert space is. So let me at least define what this is. It's a C linear category C, which comes with a dagger structure. So it's a map from C to C op, and this is a proper dagger structure. In addition, it has some trace maps. So for any object in C, I get a map from the endomorphisms of C to the complex numbers. And if I have these two types of structures, what I can do is I actually can, if I have F from C to C prime and G from C to C prime, I can define a pairing of F and G as applying lambda C to, I first do G and then F dagger. And the condition is that this is a Hilbert space pairing. This is supposed to.
This is also some sort of dimensionality for lambda, is that what you're saying?
What? No, I think.
Like lambda should be something on every object.
Lambda is something on every object which has a bunch of compatibility conditions, has some symmetry property and things like that. So.
So like one of those.
This is like, this is, should be a. You might call this a like super Calabi-Yau structure. So it's somehow it's a super Calabi-Yau structure. I mean, what it really is, it's a trivialization of the Serre automorphism, which you can, I mean, you, I might have this formula here. And since we had it last time, the Serre is something like this coend. And then trivializing. So, or last week it was called the Nakayama. And trivializing this is the same as giving such a trace, which has some property, right? So for example, I can, if I have F and G, I can call, like if I have something like this from C to C prime and a G like this, I can somehow compute the trace either in C or in C prime for the composition. I want these things to be the same. There's a sign you might worry about it. This is an ungraded symmetry, which is slightly.
So that's like the symmetry of this possible linear form.
Yes. Exactly. And yeah. So and this whole data is a what's called a two Hilbert space or super two Hilbert space, and the original definition again goes back to Bias, I don't, maybe 2010 or so. And then there's the notion of unitary maps. And now you just give a definition and state one last theorem. So then extended connection positive theory is an O2 dagger functor. Board n minus 2 to S hip. And now I can state the theorem I mentioned before, which is work in progress, so there are many details to be checked, but it essentially says like 2D fully extended reflection positive spin series. They are equivalent to two super Hilbert spaces. And then we have a version for, or an expected version for all other tangential structures, where you get unitary representation theory of some internal symmetry group. And if there are some time reversing symmetries, you would expect them to act anti-unitarily. But yeah, so let me highlight this. This is somehow the main theorem, and I think this seems like a good result, which might also imply that the definition should be good. Okay, so thank you for your attention.
So this might be a dumb question, but is there an actual action of S1?
What do you mean with an actual action?
If I tell you, like, start with rotation by angle theta, can you tell me, like, the morphism of every bicategory with adjunctions?
I mean, it depends a bit on what you mean with a bicategory of adjunctions, but I would say generally you can only describe the full loop. But you might come up with a different model. I didn't mention that, but somehow what a bicategory with adjunctions should be, it should be something which allows you to evaluate string diagrams which look like this.
Right, and
so I mean,
is like grab your morphism and rotate it by three.
Exactly, and it's something like you rotate this, and there's some framing data because I don't have like pivotal structures also, so there's some.
But I mean, the answer to Ben's question is sure. If you want to rotate by angle theta, take the floor of theta and apply the SAIR that many times.
I see.
Yeah, like, but I mean,
the formula looks like it jumps, but it doesn't actually.
But this seems like, okay, you can do that, sure. But this is not, right, this is, I don't think this is the question he was asking.
I mean,
there's a definition of an O2 action, which because it's a homotopy action, I can act with this thing, and then I just need to tell you what the loop does. I mean, but more generally, if you have a model which is really defined on these things, you can take this and rotate it. And you can rotate it by any angle, and this will give you something different for every angle. So I think it's, yeah, these things are somehow sometimes model dependent. But there is an, yeah, I mean, Theo is right? I have given you an O2, or sketched an O2 action, but I think this is somehow also why you might believe statements like this to be true, is that you have this graphical calculus, which you can just take and rotate.
So in Bias's paper, he also says that you can find bases, right? Two Hilbert spaces. Forget about the super.
Yeah. I mean, I already sneaked in the bases a while ago because I said they're semi-simple, so I always have like something like a basis, and it's even more canonical than the usual basis you have.
So that requires the Dyer structure and also semi-simplicity, or?
I mean, I think he. Right, this definition I can give without semi-simplicity.
Right.
And one of Bias's results is that this implies semi-simplicity. I mean, which you should expect. Unitarity usually gives you some type of semi-simplicity. That's because it makes it easier to take complements. Yeah. Did that answer your question, or did I just
I wanted to ask, like, what's the basis in
Bort? Oh, Bort doesn't have a basis. I mean, I don't even know how. It's not linear, so I think the statement doesn't compile to for me. I don't think it makes sense to ask that.
All right. Just thank Lucas again.